Good evening, friends. Welcome to Valley Writers Read. Tonight, one story written by two mothers who suffered through very similar tragic circumstances. Each of them lost a child to addiction. The mothers are Armin Bacon and Nancy Miller, and they collaborated on the story you're about to hear. They've entitled their story, Griefland, An Intimate Portrait of Love, Loss, and Unlikely Friendship. Here they are, Armin Bacon and Nancy Miller.
The Boy Who Wanted to Fly. We lived in three houses during Alex's brief lifetime. There was the house where he was conceived, another where he was born, and the third where he spent a majority of his teenaged years negotiating with monsters he insisted were hiding underneath his bed. Although I never actually saw them, I could sometimes hear whispers late at night. By the look in his eyes, they were a constant presence hovering around him. Without any warning, he would run like a track star down our two flights of stairs and then stand perfectly still in the middle of the living room with his lanky arms tightly wrapped around himself, his appearance cold and stiff, as if he had just escaped a blizzard or avalanche. His body language, those arms encircling his torso, hinted that my son was holding on for dear life. As for me, I wasn't doing much better. I feared for his life. A mother knows. When we made eye contact, I could see that he was trying to tell me something, but couldn't get the words out, as if maybe he was being held hostage over some important piece of information that only he knew. Without embarrassing him or force-feeding a conversation, I would deliver a dish of his favorite tapioca pudding, or hand him a stack of folded laundry, and then sit on the corner of his bed to create a moment of opportunity between us. Neither of us was comfortable with the language we were attempting to speak. By the time he hit high school, his hazel eyes were starting to glaze, diminish in size and clarity. A distant look in his stare gave him the appearance of a stranger or alien, a foreigner, someone I wasn't sure I knew or even trusted. Instinctively, though, I would grab him, as only a mother can when she feels her child is in danger or harm's way, embracing him with a gigantic bear hug, holding on tight until one of us finally let go. On the way out the door, I would always remind him, "I love you, Alex." "I love you more, Mom," he would add, and then quickly shut the door. He always had the last word. He was a beautiful and spirited child. He loved school, sea creatures, stray dogs, and all things made from sugar. I can still hear the kitchen chair dragging across the floor as he made his way to my mixer, holding out his hand for a sampling of cookie dough or buttercream frosting, anything made from a batter. He was my Cool Whip kid and my favorite sous chef. When nobody was looking, he would stick his fingers into the sugar bowl or grab a handful of chocolate chips or miniature marshmallows, stuffing them into his mouth. Years later, a friend of mine suggested that sugar was his first addiction. His reading list began with writers like R.L. Stine and Shel Silverstein, but morphed prematurely to authors like Stephen King and Victor Hugo. He was a voracious reader. He also loved capes and wore one as an appendage during his preschool years. His teacher, Blanche Nosworthy, marveled at the makeshift wings and named Alex the boy who wanted to fly. She boasted that he was the most creative child she had come across in all of her years. She said this on the heels of discovering him dismantling a beehive in search of honey. The other children were running away with fear as Alex, high on tiptoes, was reaching and touching the hive, oblivious to the dangers of angry bees. By sixth grade, he was a well-seasoned, gifted, and talented student, singled out by many of his teachers as someone to watch. One of his teachers pulled me aside during open house to explain that Alex was filled with insatiable curiosity, a quality he warned could take him to the moon or hurl him over a cliff. Inquisitive children are always in danger of testing their own limits, he said. His prized collection of miniature figurines made from soft, pliable pewter lived in a secret hiding place in the vicinity of his allowance stash and a pile of cherished sand dollars collected from our annual trips to the beach. He would spend hours choreographing them into formation while I did household chores one floor below. I could hear him voicing each of the characters and interrupting them with explosive sound effects, the kind generated by a little boy's imagination. When he tired of them, he would move to a plastic bin of art supplies that was kept in his closet, and using a mixed media of crayons and pencils, magic markers and paint, he would create Alex art. That's what we called it. His elaborate sketches resembled Escher drawings, embellished with lizards, prehistoric figures, and now that I think about it, too many dark colors. Once, he told me he was drawing his dreams. Days later, I would discover the drawings crumbled up and discarded in the trash or shoved underneath his mattress. We began noticing subtle changes when Alex entered his teens, a hush or secrecy that seemed a bit abrupt, but then again, adolescence is an awkward passage, even for the brave at heart. Comparing notes with friends, many refreshed our memories, reminding us that it was a natural time to start distancing yourself from parents. Alex and I were especially close, so this didn't quite fit, but I was starting to feel like a stereotypical ethnic mother holding on to her son in an obsessive, clingy manner. Reluctantly, I loosened my grip. For a short time, it seemed to give us both a bit of breathing space. But then, his middle school counselor made an observation that she'd seen Alex wandering around the perimeter of the school grounds all alone at recess. Visualizing this crushed me. How could my gregarious little boy suddenly be a loner? Almost overnight, his straight A's began melting into C's and D's. At back-to-school night, two of his teachers commented he was missing classes, not turning in homework, falling asleep on his desk. We confronted him. Conversations turned into inquisitions. Alex, known for his truthful nature, admitted everything. Marijuana, over-the-counter allergy pills, cough medicines, computer-generated concoctions that made him hallucinate. His childhood fascination with creepy crawlers had grown daring, sophisticated, life-threatening. He was enchanted by the world of drugs. There were days I would physically walk him to class, stalk him from the parking lot, ensure he was not leaving his classes or campus, but there's only so much policing a mother can do. My husband refused to be his son's jailer. During the next several years, we would try tough love, Al-Anon, therapy, inpatient rehab, anything and everything. A parent never gives up. Besides, it felt more like a bad dream than reality. I was sure that at some point we would all wake up and move on with our lives. By the time he turned 18, drugs had become a steady part of his daily regime. He left trails everywhere. Tiny foil wrappings, Ziploc bags, remnant powder on the countertops, empty prescription bottles. There was paraphernalia, too, tarnished spoons that had been darkened by matches, blown glass accessories, clips for holding illegal possessions. Outraged at first, the repetition of this scene became commonplace in our otherwise pristine home. At one point, I grew so accustomed to finding them, I picked them up as if they were dirty laundry and then escorted them down to the garbage can. I had become numb and silenced by the routine appearances of these items, by the constant denial and excuses offered by my son, so much so that I wondered if I was imagining something that wasn't really happening and simply going mad. Everyone I spoke to seemed to defend Alex, explaining that he was a normal adolescent boy experimenting with manhood. Even his pediatrician assured me he was fine, but I knew better. Then came September 11. I was dressing for work and coaxing Alex from bed to get him off to school when the phone rang and someone told me to turn on the television. In the next moment, I was watching an airplane fly into one of the Twin Towers. The newscasters kept repeating the story over and over. Their voices, I remember, were breaking, something you rarely see professional newscasters do. Alex came downstairs, saw the look of horror and utter disbelief in our eyes, and without saying a word, walked to the refrigerator to grab a Coke and a bowl of cereal. He had no reaction. To this day, the expressionless look on his face remains trapped in my memory, replaying with as much intensity as the chilling sight of the Twin Towers collapsing and scattering lives and ashes everywhere. I went to church that day and prayed for the victims of 9/11, but mostly I prayed for Alex. I started believing there was a monster living inside my son. Even his comic book heroes transformed into creatures who could obliterate the world. He drew them with sharp angles and droplets of blood falling onto the paper. He was obsessed with video games and computers. Friends stopped dropping by. His world became small and dark, confined exclusively to his room between the hours of midnight and dawn, while most of the world was sleeping. As time passed and when the voices became too disruptive, he would stop what he was doing, walk outside the balcony door, and stand frozen for hours, grabbing hold of the railings, mesmerized by a familiar backdrop of darkness. I can't help but wonder if he ever caught glimpse of the stars or the moon. Some nights, I would go upstairs, stand quietly next to him, trying to ease his pain, drawing his attention to the moon, and so wanting to shine some light onto his face. I grew exhausted from worry, collapsing late at night into my bathtub, desperate for relief. Even with the water rushing full blast, I could hear the weight of his footsteps pressing against the floor. He paced back and forth across the room. Almost like clockwork, by the time I was ready to get out of the tub, I would hear his balcony door open and slam shut. Sinking deeper into the water, I would look up and have words with him, tears streaming from my eyes, knowing, of course, that a layer of ceiling muffled my pleas. There were walls and worlds between us, and monsters. Even now, almost 5 years later, I second-guess myself wondering if he ever heard my voice crying out to him. I knew he heard theirs. His high school counselor called us one day with an urgent request for a family conference. We were about to learn that Alex had confided to a student teacher his desire to jump from his bedroom balcony. His words set off an alarming list of school protocols and emergency procedures requiring us to check him into a psychiatric hospital for 72 long hours of observation. I could feel a tsunami shaking the ground beneath me. I was losing grip of my son. He was imprisoned in his own monster-infested world, barricading himself in his bedroom, painting the walls a dark shade of navy, dark like the night sky. And then he began to disappear. I woke up one morning. My insides were screaming, but by then it was too late. A few weeks later, I was sitting on his floor, propped up against his bed, writing the obituary. His door has remained shut for 5 years. His favorite books are neatly stacked. The figurines stand in formation, and one of his famed reptile drawings is now under glass and hanging on the wall in his bedroom. But there is a disturbing presence of something missing. I sneak in now and then when no one is looking to smell his shirt, fluff his pillows, clench the frame holding Alex in his Superman cape, and curse the monsters, daring them to come out from under the bed and look me in the eye.
It's not easy to be me.
So far away, doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. It doesn't help to know you're just time away. Long ago I reached for you and you're so far away. Yeah, you're so far away.
What was your daughter like? What was your daughter like is a question I hear often from people who didn't know Rachel. From students, friends, or colleagues, the question comes up. I love answering because it lets me bring her back into the present tense again. What was Rachel like? In that 10-second span between question and answer, her life unfurls in front of me. Wild, uncombed, wavy hair. Only a ponytail would keep it mildly controlled. Her eyes had a glimmer that said both mischief and excitement, exuding a contagious energy. Rachel mesmerized everyone she came into contact with. It wasn't just her beauty, which I often observed in faces turning again and again in her direction, but her sensitivity to everything and everyone around her, her X-ray vision. Her goofy laugh was infectious, a combination of hiccup and gasp. She had a playful grin she wore most of the time, as though she had a secret she would willingly give up with very little prodding. A reader, lover of all games, Barbie dolls, paper dolls, any dolls. She loved to wear dresses. A girly girl. When asked in kindergarten what her favorite color was, she said, periwinkle. None of the kids knew that color, so she described it in detail, how you have to mix lavender with light blue and a bit of pink. The teacher mentioned it during the first open house. In high school, she studied photography. She had a collection of cameras and left me hundreds of photographs, mostly of women. On an Amtrak ride home to see me, she shot an African-American woman sleeping across from her. Black and white, the look of calm, feel of easy motion, mouth open, close up. She was always trying to get close, to capture serenity, Cheshire cat smile, dimples. As she grew into an adolescent, her gigantic brown almond-shaped eyes were a perfect canvas for the eye makeup she loved to wear. In the fashion of an Egyptian queen, she reveled in making elaborate brush strokes, outlining her lids with layers of black liner and mascara, red lipstick applied with a heavy hand. But it was her hair people will remember long after everything else pales with time. At the moment of her birth, the first words came from the nurse standing next to the doctor. Oh, look at that baby's gorgeous red hair. This would be a common refrain through infancy, childhood, and adolescence. Rachel's hair was not only a magnificent shade of ruddy cranberry, but it was luxuriously thick and curly, a halo of corkscrews falling around her shoulders. It would also be the last of her features described. The extremely curly red hair measures 8 inches in length, states the autopsy report. Even in death, a coroner had taken notice. I wondered if he noted the length of all cadavers' hair. Not many knew she was a mean Scrabble player, having been a voracious reader all her life. From the time I was pregnant, I would read stories to her, convinced that if she heard stories while in the womb, that she would acquire a love of reading. As a child, I would make up stories and characters about young girls who were confronted with problems and found ways to work them out. As she grew, she devoured everything from the Chronicles of Narnia, Wizard of Oz, every children's classic I could think of, including Alice in Wonderland, anything she could get her hands on by Stephen King, to Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway. She was a writer. Even while in rehab, she produced 20-page letters to me, sharing in grand detail her demons, her hurts, her hopes. She saw through to the middle of people, to the symbolism of sacred objects such as a teddy bear. For Rachel, a teddy bear was not just a teddy bear. It encompassed an era in a person's life, reflected childhood, innocence lost, intimacy, friendship, comfort, loneliness, grief. It was a talisman. She knew that nothing was ever one thing. When Rachel died, I received a flurry of emails from people I didn't know. I discovered in reading some of these that she seemed to be able to give to others what she could not give to herself. One letter described her unwavering loyalty and optimism in helping a troubled friend overcome a huge hurdle. During a time when Rachel herself had huge hurdles to work through, she would subordinate them to ease someone else's pain. What was Rachel like? Rachel's addiction was like a tidal wave constantly rising up in front of her, and she met it as a child would, always saying, "No, you will not take me down." But in the end, she was no match for it, though she never gave up trying. During the last 5 years before her death, Rachel admitted herself repeatedly to rehab programs. She would stay clean for days, weeks, sometimes months. She never made it longer than 9 months that I know of. She always saw people as more alike than different. When she was 4 years old, someone had given her a black Barbie, and we'd taken the doll shopping later to find a friend. She found another Barbie, this time a white one, with the same dress. And she thought since they had matching dresses, they would be the greatest of friends. As we stood at checkout, the cashier said, "Why do you have a black Barbie?" Rachel's face was dumbstruck. She stood examining one doll, then the other, her brow furrowed, her eyes squinting. She said, "But they have the same dress." That was the first moment she was taught to notice difference instead of to embrace sameness. She was quiet all the way home, but gripped both dolls in her hands. She seemed from the very beginning not to be of this world at all, but part of some distant constellation or some gale force wind blowing through all our lives and then with the quiet of a candle blew out altogether. Grief hangover. The cold winter night is a long, shrill scream stuck in my ears, a siren that won't wind down. I know now how tired Rachel was. I feel her exhaustion in every breath I am taking. I know exactly where she was in her head the night she died. It seems so lucid to me now. She had told me she didn't want to live anymore, but she was afraid to die. But that last week in December depleted her more, and the desire to be released from her mental cage was stronger than the fear. I lay here in the weight of the darkness, stuck in the guts of the night, unable to focus on any one thing, hypnotized by the ceiling fan rotating rhythmically over my body for hours and hours. It's a hurricane twirling above me. I envision myself caught up in the middle of it, spinning, not able to escape. I'm exhausted, but I can't sleep. I'm starving, but I can't eat. I'm insane, but I can't give myself the permission to succumb. I open my eyes to a morning worse than that four-day binge of my youth when I drank enough to kill a small pony and had resorted to prayer, bargaining with the gods to let me survive the hangover. Only I haven't had a drink in 3 days. I'm wobbly, head pounding, feeling tipsy, walking into doors. Candles burn down, reminding me that the moment I'm in is only going to last so long, and then there will be other moments, and more moments after that, all without her. I better find my balance pretty quick. I negotiate the rise from the bed to the bathroom. Can't visualize it. I could stay in bed all day and into the night, and the days and nights all start melding together in a blur. Fragments of past experience, snapshots of memories rotating in my head. I am afraid of losing one of them, of forgetting. The only way not to lose something again is to just stay put. I close my eyes and see shadows of dark, light, half-light, nausea, stomach churning. I need to make it to the bathroom. I can't swallow. Mouth is dry, stomach empty, head spinning, and I can't focus on the edge of the bed, much less the room. When did I eat last? Maybe it's the onset of a flu virus. I know I have to get out of bed, but I can't feel my feet, and I'm fighting the urge to throw up. But I'm not hot. It's not a fever. And all at once, I remember Rachel is dead. This is the new definition of motherhood. My new role, silence, solitude, the raw reality of missing. Nothing left to do now except survive this moment. This is the grief hangover. That morning when you open your eyes and feel as though you have drunk enough to kill yourself. The dizziness, the disorientation, the sense of having lost something and needing to find it. This need is what forces you to sit up. When the nausea hits you and your mouth begins watering, you think you need to make it to the bathroom, so you stand up, but then that feeling of having misplaced something returns, and you forget the bathroom and start wandering and weaving around the house looking for it. You can't remember what it was, but you are driven by a yearning, a longing stronger than anything you've ever known before. It's pushing down on you from all sides, like a vice, like a labor pain you can't control, but can only brace yourself for. A pressure surrounding you, filling you up from the inside, forcing you out into your backyard, looking everywhere for this misplaced thing. What was it? You aren't sure because you are so exhausted you can barely keep a coherent thought in your head for 1 second. If someone came to the door right now and saw me, they would think I had pulled an all-nighter, drunk myself into a stupor and was a real mess. They'd almost be right. I am a real mess. But the stupor doesn't come from a bottle. The thing I'm looking for all over the house, outside in the garden, in the garage, is not here. I remember now that the thing missing is not a thing. It's a who, and I won't be able to find her anywhere. This is solitary confinement, a life sentence,
Doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? It would be so fine to see your face at my door. Doesn't help to know you're so far away. Yeah.
That was Armin Bacon and Nancy Miller reading a story they collaborated on writing entitled Griefland, An Intimate Portrait of Love, Loss, and Unlikely Friendship. There is very little those of us witnessing the tragic loss experienced by these two mothers can state without being trite. All we can say is that we sympathize with them, extend our sincerest condolences, and tell them that we'll do our best to understand the significance of their loss and just hope that a program like ours can give them a chance to find expression for their feelings of grief and anguish. Their experiences let all of us who are parents know how important it is to look after our children in every way possible. Friends, the two mothers we heard from tonight first became acquaintances, then friends, then co-authors, because they both experienced very similar tragedies. In a Fresno Bee article, here's what Armin Bacon tells us about their close association. We discovered a life after death. We decided to write a book together, composing a series of authentically raw narrative essays, each designed to lift the veil on a taboo subject. Thank you, Armin Bacon and Nancy Miller. Folks, what we listened to tonight were two chapters from a book which has the same title as a story we heard, Griefland, An Intimate Portrait of Love, Loss, and Unlikely Friendship. We certainly wish both of these mothers well in their future lives and much success with the book. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read story again, just go online to kvpr.org and link up with archived audio. Next week, our writer will be James Varner. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.